Welcome to A Crime Cast by Revamp. Revamp is a 501c3 nonprofit based out of Fort Smith, Arkansas. We are victim advocates. We advocate for the families of murdered and missing. We have private investigators. We have victim advocates. We have former and current law enforcement officers. And we offer a host of support to the families. But you can find out more about Revamp by following us on Facebook. Go to our Facebook page of Revamp. Remember every victim and missing person and hit the like button and you'll be notified each time that we have a new crime cast come out. You can listen to our crime cast on one of your favorite platforms, whether it be Spotify or Google or Amazon Audible, or you can just listen straight from our website. So let's get started on our story today. It's one of my favorite stories, and it is the story of Mayor Fagan Borland, his wife Julia, and his mistress Maud Allen. And this is one of my most favorite stories from the past in this area. It was September of 1895, and Fort Smith had electric streetcars. Judge Parker was ruling with an iron fist, and for the first and only time, the governor of Arkansas was a Fort Smith native. Governor Fishback was serving his last year in the governor's office. The summer heat was beginning to wind down, and it was almost bearable to walk down the avenue. The electric streetcars were running. Hangings were quite the topic of the day. In fact, just the same month, there had been a mass hanging of the Rufus Buck Gang. People in the city were quite relieved to see them gone. They were a group of young men that were found guilty of rape and murder. Fort Smith was bustling with activity, and it was a beautiful fall day to walk along the avenue and shop. A lady had to be really careful, though, when she reached the west end of the avenue, as that's where Coquille was situated, and there were a lot of undesirables within a short distance of Coquille. There was always a lot of activity on that end of the street, and it seemed like there were a lot of less desirables, along with some people that were just down on their luck, and they were just beyond the scope of Garrison Avenue. Coquille was just a shanty town of shacks and sometimes cardboard shelters that housed the poor, along with some of those that were just trying to exist beyond the arms of the Fort Smith authorities. And they liked Coquille because they could run across the railroad bridge into Oklahoma and escape apprehension. Now, Cocaine Annie, she had made headlines, and it seems as if the effect of cocaine could be seen if one ventured just a few hundred yards off the main street of Garrison Avenue. Respectable ladies would not venture past a certain point, and a respectable lady would hope that her husband would not as well. It was a common thing to see Fagan Borland on the street with his young mistress in his arms. Borland, although he was married, he was a well-known citizen, and he didn't try to hide his indiscretions. It was almost as if he wanted to flaunt in front of everybody in town. Fagan had a relationship with Maud Allen. She was a beautiful but much younger woman. Maud had been married to a man named George Allen in 1893 when she was only 19 years old. But the relationship between her and Fagan had caused her marriage to fail, and her estranged husband sued Mr. and Mrs. Borland, well, sued Fagan Borland, for alienation of affection because of his young bride, Maud. The case was settled for $10,000, and it was paid by Mr. and Mrs. Borland. I always thought it was kind of funny that Maud lived in a boarding house that was right across the street from the store that Fagan Borland operated. Maud was a petite, rather beautiful woman, and she would walk alongside Mr. Borland with her arm in his arm, strolling down the street without a care in the world. Maud was always very well dressed, and neither seemed to have any reservations about being seen mingling together on a very personal level in public. During the entire event, Fagan Borland and Maud just couldn't seem to be apart for any length of time. And I'm not really sure how long Maud and Fagan were an item before it came to the attention of the public, but I'll tell you this, most Fort Smithians did not care for Maud, and they saw her as an opportunist, as a homewrecker. She must have had really strong feelings for Fagan, and it must have been mutual. Mr. Borland did risk his marriage and his family life by flaunting the relationship, or at least you would think. But people didn't have any sympathy. They all had sympathy for Mrs. Borland during the whole dreadful ordeal. After a few months of this behavior, a broken marriage seemed to be the last thing that Maud would stand for. Regardless of how long it was going on before Mrs. Borland or the public was aware of it, one thing was for sure. Mrs. Borland was not going to stand by idle and just let it go. Mrs. Borland must have felt quite threatened by Maud Allen's beauty and petite size. Mrs. Borland was not someone that would come to your mind immediately when you would think of a beautiful, graceful young woman. Mrs. Borland probably felt pretty lucky when she married Fagin, since her greatest assets were not in her looks department, and she was not well known for being kind or compassionate. I suppose that Mrs. Borland got tired of being humiliated publicly and decided if she couldn't control her husband, then she was going to eliminate the problem. And in her eyes, the problem was Maud Allen. It was a Saturday evening in September of 1895, and Mrs. Borland armed herself with a pistol and went to the boarding house, acting on a suspicion, or a gut feeling, that her husband and Maud were having an intimate encounter. Upon finding the two lovebirds together, Mrs. Julia Borden fired several shots, but they all narrowly escaped the intended victim, Maud Allen. The shots may have not injured her physically, but it must have at the very least put a little fear into Maud, because Maud left Fort Smith soon afterwards and went to Seneca, Missouri, where her mother lived. It's unclear of the exact date that Maud left Fort Smith or how long she was away, but she didn't leave her feelings behind. She still loved Mr. Borland, and whether it was the pride or a wounded heart, it's hard to say. But she began writing letters to Fagin, and some of those letters ended up in the hands of Mrs. Borland. Later on, some of the letters surfaced that she was accused of writing, and it's still unclear whether they were really her writings or not, but they were not letters of apology, and they were not letters of regret. She definitely had no regrets about the escapades that she had had with a woman's husband, but they were letters of the worst kind. Maud's letters contained hand-drawn pictures worse than any type of graphic graffiti that you could find anywhere. One in particular was described as being pornography by any standard. The language was just as obscene and would make a sailor blush. Mrs. Borland turned the letters over to Mr. Houck, who was the postal inspector. And before long, there was a warrant for Maud's arrest. The arrest warrant was issued on March 30th, 1896, and Maud was arrested promptly. She was held in jail of a $1,000 bond. It always seemed odd that Julia had tried to kill this woman and had put so much fear into her that she had to flee the state. And not one thing was done to Julia Borland when she tried to kill Maud, but yet Maud ends up in jail over these letters that they're still not sure that she was actually the author of. When it came time for the trial, the courtroom was packed. Most people were just being nosy. Not much different than today's time, actually. Today, people watch reality and talk TV shows to peek into scandalous and bizarre events in people's lives. But at that time, you had to go down to the courthouse and listen to the details in person. The trial lasted for 2 days, and the details were enough to make anybody in the courtroom blush. They were so full of obscenities that most people couldn't even report back to repeat them. The letters were brought into evidence were odd in many ways as well. They were written as if they were in third person. The letters seemed to wish to provoke jealousy into Mrs. Borland by comparing the beautiful clothing that Fagin Borland had supplied his mistress, while his own wife was limited to worn and holy clothing. In one letter, it mentions that Fagin had purchased a beautiful shawl for Miss Maud, while his own wife was seen around town in a ragged, worn-out, old brown sweater. There were also a lot of racial slurs, sometimes written at the bottom of the notes and the letters. One cartoon-type drawing indicated a man and a woman in an intimate encounter with a crudely drawn body part that one would have expected to have really been work of an elementary student, if it weren't for the nature of the activity in the pictures. Maud Allen never denied that she wrote some of the letters, but she persistently denied that she had ever mailed any of the letters to Mrs. Borland. Maud and several witnesses actually testified that the ones that Maud had written to Fagin and the ones believed to be in Maud's handwriting were actually done by her, but the letters to Mrs. Borland did not seem to match Maud's handwriting, and the letters were all handwritten and in third person. Some of the testimony at the trial came from Molly Frazier. When the defense put Molly on the stand, she claimed that she had been in the room with Maude for the past few weeks, and she had only seen Maude write one letter, and it was to her mother. With the prosecution cross-examining her, she stated that she was a cook for Mr. West, the boarding house owner, and that she and Maude had roomed together. She said that her and Maude sleep together in the same room every night, and they're always together most all the time. She stated that even Maude doesn't cook as she does, but Maude would stay in the kitchen with her while she cooks. Molly also stated that not long ago, Maude wrote a letter to her mother in Seneca, Missouri, and she saw that letter. Molly stayed consistent on her story that she doesn't know anything about the letters that Mrs. Borland had presented to the postmaster. After Molly was questioned, they brought the owner of the boarding house to stand in courtroom, Mr. W.T.L. West. Mr. West stated that he owned the boarding house and a cow. I don't know why he mentioned the cow, but he owned a boarding house and a cow. He also said that he had mailed one letter for Maude, which was addressed to her mother in Seneca, Missouri, and that he had never mailed any letters to anyone in town or anywhere else for Maude. He testified that he knew nothing about the letters in which Maude was accused of writing, and that the basis of these charges were just ridiculous. In cross-examination, Mr. West again stated that he knew nothing about the letters in question, but he did admit he was not with Maude all the time. The last person on the stand was Maude Allen herself. Maude said she only knew about one letter, one that she had written to Fagin Borland. She did admit to Mr. Houck that she had written it, but had not asked anyone to mail it, nor had anyone mailed it for her as far as she knew. Maude claimed that some of the letters in question were in her handwriting and some were not, but none of them were ever mailed, and never had she requested any of them be mailed. But after 2 days of trial, Maude Allen was acquitted on the charge, but that wasn't the end of it. Oh no. Shortly after the verdict was handed down, Maude was arrested again on the same charge, but this time in the state of Missouri instead of Arkansas. It was the exact same charge as the one she was just acquitted on, and it appears that she was acquitted once again in Missouri. Maude had several witnesses that had stated they had seen her write letters, but all claimed she had never mailed them or asked anyone to mail them. The only witness that testified to any letter being mailed was the one letter that she had written to her mother, but no one else. It seems at that point Maude felt that she had triumphed over the situation, at least for now. And so, a few days later, back in Fort Smith, she was rekindling her relationship with Mr. Borland. Obviously, Maude was on a very self-destructive path, but or maybe she just genuinely loved Fagin. And when a woman is in love, we know that all logical thinking goes right out the door. Looking back at the situation, Fagin and Maude must have truly been in love. And it just didn't seem like anybody could keep them apart. By the following month, Mrs. Borland decided to give another attempt to eliminate the person she saw as a threat. Once again, Mrs. Borland armed herself with a pistol and happened on to Maude in front of Borland's place, just about the same spot as the beautiful Hannah Oil and Gas building sits today. It seems that maybe Mrs. Borland did some target practicing this time, as she didn't miss her target and Maude fell to the ground. Mrs. Borland began beating Maude in the head with the pistol. Fortunately for Maude, Chief Henry Surratt was working really close by. He heard the commotion and pulled Mrs. Borland off of Maude before she killed her in the street. Maude had a bullet in her body, narrowly missing her heart. Maude was rushed away to the hospital. She went to St. Spencer's Hospital, where she laid for several weeks, and then was taken back to her estranged husband's parents' house to recover. This time, Fagin didn't escape without punishment that was dealt out by Julia. At some point during the altercation, possibly while she was beating Maude with the gun, a bullet grazed Fagin Borland's leg. Fagin was actually running away from the scene when he was wounded. Coward. Fagin must have not wanted any part of protecting Maude or trying to calm down his wife. Maude ran to Fagin and embraced him, saying, "I love you, Fagin. I did it all for you." Julia Borland was once again walking away free without any penalty for shooting down an unarmed woman on a public street. There just seemed to be so much sympathy for her. It was as if she was the sole victim in the whole thing. It seems to me that she should have spent those bullets on her husband, but she obviously held Maude solely responsible for the whole affair. The doctor could not remove the bullet that had entered Maude's petite little body, and so she lived the rest of her life from that day on in constant pain. This time, Maud was in no condition to flee, even if she had her senses kick in, and she realized it might be wise to put a little distance between her and Fort Smith. Maud stayed in Fort Smith, and she went back to the boarding house where she was boarding with Mrs. T.V. Sprinkle. Mrs. Borland was now faced with the source of her problem across the street from her husband once again. And one thing I'm going to give Julia is that she was persistent. She was persistent, if nothing else. This time, Julia did not intend to fail on her mission, and she got a little more creative. The whole affair of the scandalous obscenities and attempted murders were putting on quite a show for the citizens of Fort Smith. So it was only appropriate that she add one more of her theatrics in her plan. I guess a costume was a good selection, as she dressed herself and blackened her face as if she was trying to appear that she was black instead of white. Mrs. Borland, in her costume, went to the boarding house, which was known as Fitzgerald's Boarding House. Fitzgerald sat where the U.S. Attorney's Building sits today on Fifth Street. So Julia Borland enters the Fitzgerald. And once she's in the Fitzgerald, she hides underneath the stairway in a closet. Now, Julia Borland stood quietly in the closet and awaited for the return of Maud Allen. So soon afterwards, Maud and Mrs. Sprinkle returned to the boarding house, and Maud surely sensed something was not quite right. She asked Mrs. Sprinkle to enter the house and make sure that Mrs. Borland was not waiting for her inside. Mrs. Sprinkle entered the house and saw no signs of any intruder, and she signaled for Maud to come inside, as it appeared to be safe. Maud entered behind Mrs. Sprinkle, and soon afterwards, Julia Borland emerged from the closet and fired a shot. The sound of the shot and the screams of Maud caused Mrs. Sprinkle to return to the room where she saw the two women struggling over a gun. She tried to separate the two women, but another shot went off and Maud fell to the floor. One bullet had entered her throat and the other had entered near her breast, near her heart. Mrs. Borland, while standing over the dead body of Maud, lying on the floor of her feet, said, "She's not going to be trouble to my husband anymore." Julia then turned and stated she was going home. Before taking another step, she fainted and fell to the floor as well. Once Julia regained control of herself, she went outside and waited until her husband appeared. Julia was escorted by her husband to Henry Surratt's office and questioned and released on a $5,000 bond. Fagin Borland, J.B. McDowell, and Henry Surratt were all listed as sureties on her bond. Maud's body was taken to the Burney Funeral Home and pronounced dead at the age of 26. The death certificate lists the cause of death under the line for disease, killed by Mrs. Fagin Borland. Her body was embalmed and prepared for shipment to go back to her family in Independence, Kansas. It was also stated from the notes by Jerry Atkins that the entire bill was paid for by Mr. Fagin Borland. I'll get back to that part later. One would think that Mrs. Borland would be punished for this unthinkable act, yet she never actually spent a day or an hour in jail. This all happened in June of 1897, and it seemed that life went on, and most treated Mrs. Borland no differently. And they still had sympathetic views towards her. They just felt the whole situation was pathetic, and a few felt that Julia Borland had every right to take the action to protect her territory and her marriage. Within 3 months, there were more headlines, and there was another twist. It seems that Maud's family felt that they should be compensated for Maud. The bizarre part of the lawsuit is that her family claimed that Maud sent them an average of $20 a week, and they depended on that money and felt that Mrs. Borland was responsible for their loss of income, and Maud's family sued the Borland for $25,000. And Mr. Borland promptly sent the money to the family. The following month brought Julia Borland into the courtroom. I was thinking that Julia was going to get her punishment after all those months and two attempted murders and then finally a murder. The headlines of the paper on October the 8th, 1897 stated, "As we go to press, the case of the state versus Mrs. Fagin Borland, charged with killing Maud Allen, is the defendant, while prosecuting attorney Spencerson is looking after the prosecution. The trial is expected to last near the close of the week." As was the case with Maud's obscenity charge, the courtroom was packed with standing room only. Then the bomb was dropped in Judge Bryant's courtroom. The defense was claiming that Maud had caused her own death. They claimed that Maud had threatened to kill Julia Borland several times and that Maud had even purchased a pistol and had been target practicing on a regular basis, preparing herself to attack and kill Mrs. Julia Borland. It didn't seem to matter to any of them that Mrs. Borland had entered the home of Maud, had shot an unarmed woman in her own home. It didn't even seem to matter that Julia had attempted to kill Maud twice before. The jury deliberated for 16 hours, and when the verdict came in, it was not guilty as charged. There was a brief moment of silence, but then it was quickly interrupted by clapping and shouting of approval and a heavy applause. Judge Bryant swiftly put an end to the display of approval and instructed the room to take the expressions of approval outside his courtroom. But this was not the end of the Borland story. Mm-mm. The Borlands went on with their pathetic existence and remained married. Later that year, Judge Parker passed away. I believe it might have been a couple of months after this. Then the following year, in 1898, Fort Smith suffered one of the worst tornadoes in its history. Mr. Borland had excitement follow him throughout his life, it seemed. Fagin Borland was the first in Fort Smith, Arkansas to own an automobile. He was also the first reported auto accident in Fort Smith, Arkansas. Fagin's father had operated a ferry near Belle Pointe, and the Borland family had accumulated a great deal of property in the area. But usually what Fagin got is what he wanted. The Borlands had three sons, and within less than 10 years after the scandalous affair and murder, Fagin Borland was elected mayor of Fort Smith. He served four terms. For some reason, the citizens of Fort Smith were always so forgiving when it came to the Borland family, and in particular Fagin. There was more than one time after the murders that the city would forgive and forget when it came to Fagin. Fagin was elected his first term as mayor for the city of Fort Smith in 1907. The next year, Electric Park was opened, and it was probably one of the most beautiful and exciting places in the history of Fort Smith. It sat where the current-day K. Rogers Park sits now, and it was magnificent. It had immaculately landscaped gardens. It had a pavilion with a ballroom, a theater. It was the place to be. It was appropriately named Electric Park. Most people didn't realize or don't realize what life was like and what Fort Smith offered in those days. The building had so many lights on the exterior that even if it was midnight, you would think that it was midday. Fort Smith was quite the city, always has been and always will be. As I was saying, Fagin became mayor in 1907 for the first time. The city saw some good things from Mayor Borland, but as always, Fagin seemed to have trouble following. Fagin followed trouble. Mayor Borland put in fire stations. He was active in cleaning up the city. He built sidewalks, sanitation, and he also appointed a city physician so that if someone needed medical attention, they would have access to it. Mayor Borland was the driving force between getting the bridge between Arkansas and Oklahoma over the Arkansas River, and he is responsible for the very first sidewalks on Garrison Avenue. The first two terms went pretty well for Borland. But in 1921, when he was elected for his third term, he only served 2 years of his four-year term. Borland was charged with being lax in enforcing laws against manufacturing and the sales of liquor and gambling. Borland denied all the allegations, but at the special counsel meeting, he resigned. The KKK was very influential in the recall of Mayor Borland. The Klan met in their clavern on Garrison and 9th Street. They made plans to expel Borland from his position. They accused him of misappropriating funds and for being too lenient on bootleggers and prostitutes. The Klan even ran ads in the local newspaper against Borland. At the time, Mayor Borland proclaimed to be Catholic, and the only support he received was from the Catholic box of ballots. Fort Smith quickly forgave and forgot about Borland, and they elected him mayor again for his fourth term in 1929. But this would be the worst part of his life because he had more devastating news than any troubled marriage, affairs, or murder or impeachment could bring. The Borlands had three sons, but within 5 short months, they would bury two of them. In February of 1932, Cap Borland is found dead in his home. Cap was 45 years old and had left work early that day from the Borland Dairy. Cap stopped at his mother's and she made him a sandwich. Cap left his mother's and went home to go to bed. When his wife came back to check on him, she found him dead. The newspaper said that he had been having episodes of numbness in his legs for a few weeks, and at the times he was actually unable to walk. There have always been rumors that it was actually a suicide, but in the Borland family, secrets and problems were easily kept. 5 months later, in July of 1932, another son, Morton, drowned while swimming in Lee Creek in Van Buren. Morton was an officer, a police officer in the Fort Smith Police Department, and was only 51 years of age. The reports is that he suffered leg cramps and couldn't make it to the shore. His body was found by a young man in Van Buren named Matt Floyd. Morton had lived in California for quite some time and had only recently moved back to Fort Smith and joined the police force. Morton was credited for busting a narcotic ring from Mexico that was bringing in large amounts of drugs to Fort Smith. It was estimated that the drugs from this group was bringing in an average of $5,000 worth of drugs each month. In 5 months, the Borlands had only one surviving son. Somewhere along the way, Mayor and Mrs. Borland became members of the Methodist Church. I was told that Fagan would send his assistant to the church before service to hold his pew, keeping everyone else from sitting in his favorite seat. Fans hung from the ceiling in the church, and he wanted to make sure that he sat underneath one when the weather was hot. Fagan would dress in white, maybe to try and convey the good old guys wear white, or maybe it just worked for him, because he always seemed to get people's forgiveness. Julia Borland died in the 40s, and he donated several thousand dollars to the First Methodist Church to build something in her honor. It was the Borland Bells. It may have been gunshots that rang out in 1896, but today it's bells that ring from the Borland name. That's what I think now when I hear the Borland Bells of the First Methodist Church at Fort Smith. Many people have searched for the grave of Maud Allen with no results. It was always thought that her body was sent to Independence for burial, but several people in the area believe that she was laid to rest close by Fagan, as Fagan never wanted any distance between him and his beautiful Maud. And there is a grave next to Fagan and his wife that there are rumors that Maud's in that grave. I suppose that Fagan wanted to keep Maud nearby even after death. And that is the story of Mayor Fagan Borland of Fort Smith, Arkansas, and the murder of his mistress. This has been an episode of Stories from the Past. For more information on more recent homicides and unsolved cases, and those of missing persons, visit us on our website at www.rememberEveryVictim.com and also on Facebook under Revamp, which stands for Remember Every Victim and Missing Person. Thank you so much.